Okay, Joe's checked in. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Time to begin the TechNet as we've done for lots of years. Main purpose of the TechNet is to bring together curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, how these transmitters, receivers, and antennas really work, and we discuss that. We teach each other what we've learned in the process of tinkering in our basements and ham radio rooms and backyards and whatever, and towers and antennas. Antennas are a very important part of a ham radio setup, and so we quite often discuss antennas. The TechNet is broken up into roughly three sections. The first section, people sign in with their questions, comments. The second section is run by Dr. Roy, C2GS, who runs the mailbag and science talk. And the third section is run by Paul, WS2N, who gives us the space report, tells us what NASA is doing and who's going to the International Space Station and who's coming back down, whatever. There will be, if we have a late night tonight, in other words, not many people checking in, I have a set of puzzles that were mailed to me a whole lot of years ago by somebody whose call letters I've forgotten, who is now a silent key. But it's on the subject, generally on the subject of standing wave ratio, which is highly misunderstood by an awful lot of people. When we go over to Roy, he's got a puzzle tonight that's going to be a good stumper, as well as some other good technical subjects. So at this time, you're going to sign in. If you do have a question or a comment, you're going to give me your call letters, your name. Try to remember to give me your name. I think I'm rather forgetful of names. And the word yes, meaning you do have a question or comment. Another thing we might have tonight is because of the Hamfest that existed today, people might also sign in and go on the list because they want to tell us their impression of the Hamfest. What great bargain did they get? What one got away? What did you sell? Did you sell everything you brought with you to sell and so on? So you telling us what the Hamfest was like from your point of view in Levittown, let us know. So right now I'm taking check-ins. Call letters and name, please. K2RIW in the TechNet. Was the Hamfest so tiring that everyone went to sleep? There's no one, had no one left? Anyone to check in because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet? Please give me your call letters right now, and I'm checking to see that the Selden section is coming out pretty well. So give me your call letters and name, K2RIW listening.
WB2GXM, Rich. I want to hear your puzzles.
Okay, Rich. We'll do that. So we're going to take Joe first. W2RYY usually has some stumpers. Let's see what he's got tonight. You got it, Joe. K2RIW.
Well, good evening, Dick. I tried to check in last week, and you heard my signal rather noisily from a handy talkie, and it really shouldn't have been. That's a little bit of a strange problem, but that's what my question is. So here goes, and this is a good one for you. How do you achieve the proper uplink and downlink performance of a repeater system and maintain same? Back to you.
Since the vast majority of the repeaters we know about have one single antenna for transmitting and receiving, that puts an extremely severe requirement on the duplexing filter. There's a filter that passes the transmitted frequency very narrow-bandedly, with all the side lobes being suppressed by lots and lots of dBs. So there's a portion of the filter which passes the transmitter signal through the filter into the antenna. There's another portion of the duplexing filter which takes the receiving frequency, usually 600 kCOA on 2 meters, and passes it through the filter into the receiver. And if the filter is really doing its job, you would like the filter to have something like 120 decibels of isolation between the transmit frequency and the receive frequency. In other words, when the transmitter turns on, in this case it's on 146.85 megahertz, the signal that comes out of the receiver port should be 120 decibels weaker than the signal that went into the transmitter port of this duplexing filter. The duplexing filter is a three-port device. It's got one port connected to the transmitter, one port connected to the receiver, one port connected to the antenna. which is common to both. So by very fancy filtering, you want that much isolation. The reason you want that isolation, let me drop this, is because your signal from the transmitter might be 50 watts of output. And if any signal of a nearby frequency is any stronger than, let me pick a number, minus 20 dBm, a stronger signal than minus 20 dBm, the receiver goes into a front-end overload and starts creating intermod, starts mixing signals together, the second harmonic of the transmitter frequency, the third harmonic of the transmitter frequency, mixed with the first, second, and third harmonics of the receiver frequency. There's all kinds of combinations by which other signals can come through, particularly if your repeater is located on a busy site like the top of the building this one is located on, where there's a whole lot of other transmitters. And that duplexing filter, if it's doing its job, should reject all of those other signals from getting into the receiver. So the way you test this is that you find out how weak your signal coming into the antenna will make the receiver properly respond, open it, squelch, and potentially turn on the transmitter. Let me drop. So if you got a real good repeater, a real good duplexing filter, it might have a sensitivity of 0.05 microvolts. That's possible. There's some that are good, that good. 0.05, or a 20th of a microvolt coming into the receiver gives it a reasonable signal, maybe a 15 or 20 dB signal-to-noise ratio. 20 dB of quieting in the old days. 12 dB of sine add, system-to-noise plus distortion. So when you're getting that sensitivity of the receiver, you're putting in a weak signal by some means, going through a great big bug-like device, they call it, or a directional coupler. So you inject a weak signal, 0.05 microvolts. Then turn on the transmitter of the repeater, and if the repeater is really doing a good job, there should be no descent. The quality of the signal coming out of the receiver shouldn't change when the transmitter goes on and off. That's a rare circumstance. Almost every repeater will have a little bit of descent. You turn on the transmitter, and the receiver sensitivity changes a little bit. That's due to saturation somewhere in one of the stages. And that saturation can create an awful lot of grief, because any signal, any stage that's going into saturation, let me drop, is by definition being shoved into a period, a portion of its nonlinear characteristic. It may be chopping off the tops of the sine waves of the signal coming in. There's all kinds of things it can do that are nonlinear, which creates mixing products. So the alignment of that duplexing filter is extremely critical, very difficult. As I said, a really good one, you'd like to have 120 dB of isolation. A state-of-the-art spectrum analyzer only has about 100 decibels of dynamic range on that screen. So how can you measure response 120 dB down? There's various ways you can do it. It takes some trickery in the way you rearrange things from different portions of the test. So making sure that you don't get descents, making sure that you've got enough filtering, enough isolation, an antenna that has low enough standing wave ratio. If the antenna presents a poor load to the transmitter, that's another source of grief. It's also like no common mode currents flowing on the transmission line going to the antenna. You'd like it all to be very well shielded, usually coaxial cable. So the repeater itself, you'd like it to be, let me drop, on a high enough location so that it can hear signals from, let's say, 50 miles away, and signals and receivers 50 miles away can hear it. So the repeater should be on a high location. And if you're real lucky, that high location doesn't have a whole lot of other very close transmitters. The repeater also requires something else. There's got to be an isolating device. Usually it's a circulator. It's made out of ferrite and magnets in front of the transmitter, right on the output of the transmitter. You put an isolator. The reason for that, any signals that are strong coming down the antenna that manage to get into the final stage of your transmitter, the transmitter is almost always running in case of FM repeater. The last stage is running Class C. Class C is a very efficient, non-linear mode. So any extraneous signals coming from the antenna into the transmitter output stage will get mixed into M by N, mic by November products. And so your repeater can easily be jammed by signals coming in. And by the way, the transmitter in that process of doing that mixing, can generate signals that create descents in other equipments on top of that building with you. So every single transmitter on top of that building must have a circulator, something that will take the signals flowing back into the transmitter and absorb them. It only allows the signals to flow one way, out of the transmitter, through the circulator, into the filter, and out to the antenna. So the circulator, if it's doing its job, it's got 20 or 30 dB of isolation between signals flowing one direction versus the other direction. And every single transmitter on that building needs a circulator, an isolating circulator, to protect all the other equipment. What sometimes happens, let me drop, is that somebody coming to the transmitter to do periodic alignment knows that the transmitter is supposed to be putting out 50 watts. He measures the power coming into the duplexing filter, and he measures 45 watts. He goes back and he tries tweaking the transmitter. He can't get any more than 45 watts. He does a further test and he finds out the circulator has got an insertion loss of half a dB. So the 50 watts going into the circulator came out as 45. So he's got the bright idea, well, that's creating an insertion loss. I'll just simply take that isolating filter out of there, that circulator. I'll take it out, bypass it. And boy, when you do that, an awful lot of people are going to become very unhappy with you real fast, the other people operating the other equipment on top of that building, because your transmitter is now going to become an extraneous signal generator because of signals coming into its antenna, into that transmitter final stage, and getting mixed into other products. And one of those products is going to jam somebody else's front end, and when they finally found out who you are, they're going to be very unhappy with you. So these are a few of the characteristics I know about repeaters. You set up quite a number of repeaters in your day, Joe, so I'm sure you've got quite a number of other hints. The B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, yeah, but I'll keep my comments of what I do to myself, because it really doesn't pertain to other entities, situations, and how they do things. Some do it with a commercial standard type of thinking, and if they take their equipment, which has a sensitivity of 100 dBm or worse, and they hook that to the receiver port, and they say, I don't see any noise, then it must be working correctly. So, okay. I guess I have two final questions for you related to this subject. Number one, how come you're not on the repeater technical committee, number one? And number two, who's going to take your place because you decided to hang up your hat? Back to you, Dick.
I am guessing that Roy and Paul will continue the TechNet if I dry up and go away. That's a guess on my part. They certainly have the capability of doing it. And so the TechNet has got a tradition of, I guess it's now going on 37 and a half years. September of 1982 is when the first TechNet began, which, by the way, was on another repeater in those days. It was on the 147-000 repeater. And for a bunch of technical reasons, it had to move. It ended up here after a year or two, as I remember. So I think they will continue. Nothing else I was going to mention with reference to repeater. Oh, if your repeater has anything nearby that acts as a rusty bolt, and know that at one time you set up temporarily, you wanted to test an antenna, and it was a nice metal post in the backyard that happened to be one of the support rods for a chain link fence, and you set the antenna up on top of that rod. A chain link fence, if you know about it, it's got a whole lot of wires twisted together, making a whole lot of contacts with each other. As the wind blows and all those contacts make and break, that creates an awful lot of passive intermodulation distortion. So can dissimilar metals inside of a connector, for instance. You've got a silver-plated connector in contact with brass. I think that the combination that might be making passive intermodulation distortion right at the connector itself going through the antenna. So it's amazing that if you don't have micro-ohms of contact resistance between interfacing pieces of metal that are part of the transmission line system, it can create intermodulation distortion passively. No active circuit in there at all. So the rusty bolt phenomena is what they call that. A rusty bolt near a transmitting antenna can create intermodulation distortion, mixing various signals that are present on the top of that building. I remember when I first heard, let me drop. I first heard about the concept of passive intermodulation distortion, I couldn't believe it. Because every transmitter has got side lobes that fall off. If you look at the spectral purity on an ideal spectrum analyzer, a really pure oscillator would be one vertical line on, let's say, 146.85 megacycles and no other signal. Well, that's not realistic. Because of the spectral purity of the local oscillator within the spectrum analyzer, and because of the spectral purity of the oscillator that's in your transmitter, when you look at it on a high dynamic range spectrum analyzer in close, it'll look like a Gaussian curve. You will see skirts to the right and to the left of that transmitter. 50, 60, 70, 80 dB down, you will see signals. You'll see noise. Every transmitter has that. Every receiver has that to some degree. And so one of the characteristics of your duplexing filter is to take those noise sidebands that are 600 kc away from your transmitter that fall on your receiver frequency and create a notch at that frequency so that does not create descents into your receiver coming from your own transmitter. Spectral purity is another art and science about oscillators that if you Google the word spectral purity, oscillator spectral purity, and passive intermodulation distortion, PIM, P-I-M, and start reading those articles. At first, it'll sound to you crazy, but it's really something that takes place. By the way, Joe, did you go to the Hamfest today? And if so, what got away from you? To P2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
No, didn't go to the Hamfest. I'm not going to comment on it. I didn't attend. Maybe some other time. But speaking about the time you came over and you witnessed that particular test I was performing with a repeater antenna, was about 60 linear feet away from the test antenna, and the test antenna is producing a signal. And if you notice that the chain link fence, when it was moved, didn't make a lot of difference, but what made a lot of difference, and this would have been a real, you know, easier to try to find if this actually happened in some location, was, do you remember when I moved my, when I operated my garage door, which is a mechanical device, and it started lowering the garage door, as those pulleys and so forth moved with the metal, you could hear that interaction static in the receiver of my repeater while I was transmitting. That would have been a difficult problem to find. What do you say about that? Because that was halfway between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of a single antenna repeater site with a duplexing filter, it really pushes the state of the art of filtering, matching, rejecting, and so on. So any two pieces of metal that have RF signal on them that are scratching against each other because of rolling, sliding, or whatever, is capable of making passive intermodulation distortion, and those noise components falling into the receiver will create the desensitization. So PIM is a very important parameter to be measured on the connectors of cables, hard lines, and whatever, particularly with reference to cell phone operations. They also have some severe requirements on filtering and PIM rejection. Your antenna on a cell site might have a connector that's held in place by way of rivets, for instance. Those rivets create scratchy contacts at times and create all kinds of grief on the cell site receiver system. So your garage door operating, the scratchy sounds, you hear that coming out of the repeater when the repeater was listening to a weak signal. Is that true, Joe? A really strong signal may override that. But a weak signal, near threshold signal coming in a repeater, can find all kinds of local rusty bolts, sliding metal, just wiggling a connector, if it's not an ideal interface of the male and female connector, can create noise like the kind we're talking about. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Yeah, I remember that, because I happened to just do that and not really even think about the outcome of what that was doing, but that was an interesting observation. You observed it, and I thought there's a little, he didn't pay a lot of attention to it at the time. He thought the chain link fence was going to be the primary culprit, and it really wasn't. But say you found that out at a repeater location with all the high level transmitter signals that you have up there, how are you going to listen with something very sensitive to hear that intermon coming from a particular metallic junction someplace on your receive frequency to find out who is making that kind of problem for you? Back to you, Dick. That's my last question for this round.
When I was doing some work at Edwards Air Force Base, there was a guy who came from the Oklahoma or the Northern Texas, I think it was the Oklahoma division of Rockwell, who had something he called a sniffer. It had two horn antennas side by side. One was doing the transmitting and one was doing the receiving. And they were mounted on something like a yardstick. Maybe the two horns were a yard apart. And a box full of electronics midway between the two. This was a complete radar system. One horn would do transmitting of brief pulses. The other horn would do receiving. And he would take the sniffer and aim it at an aircraft and find out which portion of the aircraft was giving how much echo to a radar system. So if you're building a very stealthy aircraft, one that you want to not show up on a radar, and you want to find out which portion of the surface of the aircraft is not doing its job correctly, you would walk around the aircraft and aim the sniffer at the wing interface with the fuselage and the tail feathers and the rudder and elevator and whatever and the flaps coming down. You would aim at various portions and find out what is giving the echo. You would aim at the cockpit, for instance. There's all kinds of things in the cockpit behind the windshield that's capable of making echoes to a radar. Aim it at the engine, particularly with the engine with the blades turning. You take, for instance, certain kinds of jet aircraft to create something called jet engine modulation. Let me drop this. When you look down the throat of a jet engine and you've got the rotor and stator blades intermeshing between each other, depending on what aircraft it is, it makes a very characteristic sound into a radar system. So it is possible to look at the jet engine modulation from a particular aircraft and say, I recognize that. That's an F-15. Go. I recognize that particular engine sound. So to a radar, all kinds of things can make echo. So you can build yourself a sniffer system. You can build yourself an extremely sensitive receiver with even a simple whip antenna. And if the receiver had very high sensitivity and was tunable, you could tune it to various frequencies while walking around at the top of the building. When you got near those rusty wheels rolling past each other, you would hear a definite increase in the sound as you got near it, coming in, the extraneous sounds coming into your receiver. So a sensitive sniffer receiver is one way it could be done. I didn't say it's easy, but to do it on your fixed equipment, to pin down what it is, you'd have to have a real good set of well-trained eyes to know what kind of hardware, what kind of rusty bolts, and what kind of sliding pieces of metal, and chain link fence, and garage door opener. You'd know what to look for if you've got experience in how passive intermodulation distortion is created. You could look at the scenario and discuss what things are capable of making that sound, and then with a sniffer receiver held near them, you could confirm by inverse square law, as you got closer and closer to the source of the noise, you would hear the noise getting louder and louder. I didn't say it's easy, but it could be done that way, Joe. Have you ever done anything like that? W2RYY, K2RIW.
No, that's a very interesting concept to think about. I would imagine something like that might have to be employed on a building like this to be able to find the noise, because it could be anything. It could be, for example, air conditioning compressors on the roof running, or turning on, turning off, or doing something, fan operating on and off and so forth, that could be taking that signal, or anybody's signal, from any antenna on the building within somewhat of a close proximity, and re-radiating the noise all over the place. That would be a real challenge, don't you think?
Oh, yes. On top of a building that's got a whole lot of transmitters, like Glen Oak does, here you've got to have your hardware well turned and tied down. No rusty bolts making scratchy contacts. The mounting of an antenna on its post, on its metal post, you got to worry about that interface eventually becoming rusty, and as the wind is blowing the antenna back and forth, creating grief. As station master-like antenna has a finite life when it's mounted at the base on top of a windy top of a building. Waving back and forth will eventually create scratchy contacts within the antenna itself. Now, this is the most ideal world. You'll have something that grabs some dielectric material that grabs the top of the antenna and stops it from swaying in the wind, bouncing it on the side of a tower, so to speak. Or even putting nylon ropes to the top of the antenna to guy it so that it's not capable of swinging back and forth. You'll drastically increase the life of your station master. But the station master mounted from the base, waving in the breeze, my guess is by the time the antenna is 5 years old, you're probably making scratchy noises on a windy day. It's about 5 years, the maximum life you can expect out of a station master-like antenna on top of Glen Oaks. Does that sound like about the right number to you, Joe? To be 2RYY, K2RIW?
Well, I couldn't begin to answer that question. That's another completely different environment than I have my equipment located on. I'm a much lower building, much less wind. So it's a completely different type of input to that equation up there to where I am. I couldn't answer that question. I've had my antenna, which is a 24 UHF antenna, on top of my building where I have a repeater located, and I don't have any issues with it moving back and forth. Because I have checked on a windy day, I'll get swishing back and forth as far as signal level, but I don't really have any descents that I've ever detected when doing an on-the-air test.
So you're kind of lucky. I think you're saying at the location where you've got your repeater, there aren't a whole lot of high power transmitters nearby. Is that what you're saying, Joe?
Most certainly, as with any relatively high building within a certain geographical radius from one to another. Everybody goes for a higher building, and if there's something accessible, a building's accessible, everybody wants to be on top of it, especially cell sites. So it creates a lot of issues. And the bigger the building, the more stuff you're going to find on top of it.
There's also a very strong inverse square law phenomenon going on here. The spacing between transmitters is very critical as to how much interference will take place. The most severe environment I know of is a Jeep in a wartime environment. There are times when you have 2, 3, and 4 whip antennas mounted to the bumper of one single Jeep with various transmitters and receivers. And you want all of that equipment to work correctly. Or inside of an aircraft, you got all kinds of transmitting receiving antennas inside of an aircraft. And you want them all to be compatible with each other. And to confirm that compatibility, to turn on and off each one of those pieces of hardware one at a time and find out which one interferes with the others, in what combinations. That testing can take an awful lot of man hours to go through all the combinations, tune all the possible frequencies and so on, and find out what interference you're going to get. So to have nearby transmitted receivers nearly co-located going into separate antennas that are nearby, severe requirement. And if you think about what's going on here, a good receiver might have a sensitivity of 1 microvolt is minus 107, 10th of a microvolt is 127. So your receiver might have a sensitivity of minus 130 dBm. dB with reference to 1 milliwatt, 130 dB down might be the receiver sensitivity. Your transmitter may be putting out 100 watts. 100 watts is plus 50 dBm. So the difference between the transmit power, plus 50, and the receiver sensitivity, minus 130, is 180 decibels. You want to look at the ratio between the transmit power and the receiver power. It's 1, because 180 dB is 1 with 18 zeros after it, is the ratio between transmit power and receive power, and that extreme example I'm giving you right now. That gives you some idea of how sensitive a receiver is, how extremely potent the signal out of a transmitter is by comparison, and how easily you can get overload. Let me drop. Almost every receiver you have ever used, radio receiver, between the antenna port and the loudspeaker, almost every receiver has roughly 120 decibels of gain. You add up the gain of the RF amplifiers, the IF amplifiers, the detector, the audio amplifier, 120 decibels of gain. That's 1 with 12 zeros after it, as far as the ratio of input power versus audio output power. So when a signal that's, let's say, 50, 80 dB above threshold on some nearby frequency comes into your receiver, depending on how narrow band is the filter on your RF amplifier, how high a dynamic range is your mixer, how dynamic range is the IF amplifier, how much filtering and so on. As you put in a strong signal, somewhere downrange, some stage is going to saturate and give you grief when you put in strong signals. So to make a receiver bulletproof to tolerate strong nearby signals without desensing, without changing its characteristics, that's a very severe engineering requirement, requiring the best of possible filters and the highest possible dynamic range of the stages. Take a real high dynamic range of a stage. You literally have to make sure, let me drop this. You have to almost make sure the stage we're talking about, an RF amplifier, made it out of something that can take a very strong signal without saturating, like a small transmitter amplifier used as the RF amplifier in the front end. That's one way of stopping it from saturating. Make it have very high power output before it starts flat topping. Do that on every one of the stages in a receiver, of course. It's difficult, expensive, not done. So in the case of the receiver that was being used, it was a Motorola handy-talkie being used by astronaut Owen Garriott, W5LFL, on the space shuttle. What year was this? Somewhere around 1970, I think it was. He's flying over Texas with an antenna taped to the window of the space shuttle while the space shuttle is upside down, so the window is facing the Earth. He's over northern Texas, transmitting with his 5-watt handy-talkie. I'm in the parking lot of AIO Instruments Laboratory with my 5/8 mag mount on the top of my car, and I'm hearing his signal on 2 meters. And I transmit back to him saying, hello, Owen. Well, because he is at such a high altitude, there is a circle of humanity about 1,000 miles in diameter around him where every transmitter in that area is coming into that handy-talkie. And when you listen to the tape recording he made of what he heard up there, and you try to pick out all the call letters that he was hearing, wow, wall-to-wall intimates. That's the wickedest environment in the world. He's 200 miles above the Earth, and looking at all of those transmitters that are, let me drop this. All of those AM, FM, and television broadcast transmitters, and radars, and police radios, and everything else. Thousands and thousands of radios are all transmitting signals that have direct line of sight to him. Your handy-talkie, running 5 watts of output, can talk 1,500 miles line of sight to an astronaut on a space shuttle over northern Texas. I did it. I heard him. So how much range do you get out of a handy-talkie with 5 watts? If you're on the ground and transmitting through houses and trees and everything else, you may think the range of your handy-talkie going to a single, similar handy-talkie, is 1 mile, 2 miles. It can be as much as 1,500 miles when you really have line of sight. You study the inverse square law, how when a signal flows through 1,500 miles of space, how much weaker does it get? And there's a formula you can use for this. Free space loss is 36 point plus 6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. You take the frequency F, megahertz, take 20 times the log of it, the distance in miles, that's the D, take 20 times the log of it, add those two numbers together with 36.6 dB, and you know the free space insertion loss for that frequency, for that number of miles, if it's truly free space, like going to the astronauts. But if you've got to go over the hill, through the buildings, through the forest of trees, past the water tower and all this other stuff, handy-talkie to handy-talkie, 1 mile can become 1,500 miles. Ain't that crazy? W-A-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-A-W in the tech net.
Yeah, I believe that was in the early 80s, not 70s, that Owen Gary had a radio with him, an amateur radio. And by the way, that radio was a MX series radio made by Motorola, specially constructed by Motorola for him to be operating superbly in the amateur band of frequencies. What do you think about that for a product?
What do you think they did specially to that handy-talkie? He had a fancy taped antenna that he taped to the window with a coax cable coming out of it that went into the Motorola handy-talkie. But what do you think Motorola did to that handy-talkie to make it more desirable for that environment? probably being fed off of the power that's on the space shuttle itself. So there's probably some kind of a converter taking space shuttle power, converting it to, say, 12 volts and feeding it into that handy-talkie. But that handy-talkie really needed an extremely well-filtered front end, which I think it didn't have. There's not enough room in there to give it the degree of filtering required so that only the ham band comes through and all those thousands of other transmitters and all those adjacent frequencies doesn't bomb the front end. When you listen to that tape recording that he provided, boy, do you hear an awful lot of signals. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
WTRYY. Back in those days, those radios had mechanically tuned, I guess you'd probably call it like a helical resonator type of filter in an RF front end. They were not electronic track tuning like you have in current radios now. They were actually mechanical filter, micromanager mechanical filter. And those people are known for being able to make something very, very small and have a tremendous amount of out-of-band rejection. So that's a starting point as far as keeping everything else out of your ball field. As far as all the thousands of signals that could be 5 meg, 10 meg out of your band, that would totally overload something like a regular Japanese-type radio. That's probably why he didn't bring something like that up there with him. So, you know, that was a good plus to Motorola when they, you know, that news got around that they took a MX series radio and specially constructed and altered it to operate better than factory spec for him, just to operate in the ham band where he's operating from 145 to 147. So, okay, that's a good, definitely a very interesting subject, the whole thing to talk about. So I guess you want to take care of the next guy here because it's 8:38 p.m. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, who is that next guy? That was B2GXM. Rich wanted us to go through this list of puzzles that were supplied to me by, I thought his call letters were W2QOV. And now a silent key, when you look up W2QOV, it's got somebody else in California. Like those call letters have been reassigned. Can't remember this guy's name, but he was part of the group on Long Island that was helping ham radio operators approach their zoning board in order to put up towers and antennas on their property. I can't think of the name of the group that I was a member of. Oh, well. What was the name of that group? It had a catchy, you know, set of acronym. So here's what he supplied to me is a list of true-false questions. And it's a total of 11 of them here, I think. So which one of these questions are true or false? Here's question number one. High standing wave ratio in a transmission, coaxial transmission line caused by a severe mismatch at the antenna produces antenna currents in the transmission line that will make it radiate. Is that statement true or false? What do you guys think? Statement number one.
WB2GXM.
You got it, Rich.
I am inclined to say that is false. The transmission line will not radiate.
Give that man a cigar. Absolutely right. Standing wave ratio really means that when a signal flows down, let's say a 50-ohm impedance coaxial cable, if the antenna presents a perfect 50-ohm resistive match, all the signal gets absorbed by the antenna and nothing reflects back. If the antenna is anything but a pure 50-ohm resistor, if there's a little bit of capacitive inductive reductance, if it's a little bit higher or lower than 50 ohms in resistive impedance, anything creating a mismatch, in other words, the exact impedance of your antenna is a dot somewhere on your Smith chart. And if the dot is not in the center of the Smith chart representing its perfect 50-ohm impedance, if it's anywhere else, some predictable amount of signal hitting the antenna will reflect back down that transmission line. If the transmission line is working correctly with well-shielded connectors and good braid coverage and whatever, the signal being reflected down the line goes back toward the transmitter, but it's still inside of a shielded system that does not in itself create radiation. There's a slight exception to that. If your coax cable has got only single layer of shielding, which is good for about 60 dB of shielding, or double layer of shielding, which is good for about 90 dB, RG9 or RG214, the the signal coming back down makes hotspots. In other words, if you had a slotted line used on that transmission line, every half wave you'd find a peak and a valley of signal because there's a signal going forward, a signal coming back. In some places they're in phase, in some places they're out of phase. So because of the leakage of your... Let me drop this. Because of the leakage of your transmission line that has less than perfect coverage of its braid, and the signal coming out of there is 60 dB down, so the signal 60 dB down will now have some hot spots where the standing wave ratio is creating higher voltages and higher currents. So the amount of radiation from the cable will increase by a couple of dB, nothing drastic. So the standing wave ratio could create a little extra isolation if you had a very sensitive receiver mounted near the outside of the cable with a sniffer and you're measuring leakage of the cable. So I agree with you, Rich. The signal, the problem is primarily false. I mean, of course, you and I would call radiation, if I'm putting 50 watts into a transmission line and 1 watt of it's being radiated by the antenna, by the cable, that's real radiation. But if the signal is 60 dB down, 1/1,000,000 of a watt, and now you get 2/1,000,000 of a watt because of the standing wave ratio. Without very sensitive equipment, you couldn't see that difference. So 99% of the time, that signal, that question is false. Here's question number two. If instead of a coaxial line, open wire line is used in the above statement, the line will radiate because of standing wave ratio. Is that true or false? JXM. You got it, Rich.
Once again, the answer is false.
You're absolutely right. If you're truly using open wire line in the ideal manner, which means you've got a perfect differential transmitter at one end, in other words, at the instant the right-hand wire is +1 volt, the left-hand wire is -1 volt during the RF cycle, you get the right kind of a balancing device, and you're really feeding the transmission line in a fully differential manner at the transmitting end, and receiving in a fully differential manner in the receiving end, the far end of the transmission line, open wire line, even though your eye says that is, there's a two pieces of wire side by side, no real shielding, you would think that's going to radiate like crazy. Properly used, you'd be amazed how well shielded that line is. Very little radiation takes place. Unless one of those lines comes near a piece of sheet metal, makes sharp bends, goes around a corner, there's a whole bunch of, the line's got to be straight and well-fed in order to be well-shielded. But a twisted pair of wires being properly fed is a very well-shielded piece of transmission line, believe it or not. There's a whole lot of computer signals flowing inside of fancy pieces of military electronics that use twisted pair, you know, black and yellow wires twisted together as a transmission line, bringing a signal from one point in the box to another point. You can, here's question number three. You can determine the resonant frequency of an antenna by probing the input end of the feed line with a grid dip meter. What do you think of that one, Rich? KQRIW?
Well, there, I am not so sure. My guess is no.
Yeah, that's false. At certain frequencies, your antenna might be a perfect short circuit. A perfect short circuit after three wavelengths of transmission line represents a kind of a filter. You put a loop of wire between center conductor and shield at the input end of that transmission line, couple it to your grid dip meter. You will find the resonant frequency created by the length of the transmission line and the short circuit at the far end. You'll get that for the second harmonics, the third harmonics, the fourth harmonics. You'll find a whole bunch of resonant frequencies that you think is the antenna. It could simply be the length of the transmission line. When you hit the real resonant frequency of the antenna, and the signal flowing down the transmission line, all of it is absorbed by the antenna and nothing is reflected back, the grid tip meter will show no response at that time. So the grid tip meter not responding could be an indication that that's where the antenna is resonating. So can you really determine the resonant frequency of your antenna at the shack end of a transmission line? The answer is almost always no. The next one. Even in high-quality transmission lines, reflected power is lost power. True or false? What do you think, Rich?
I know the answer to this, but I can't be the only person at this table. Anybody else?
Yeah, you guys, when power is being reflected on a transmission line because the antenna presents a standing wave ratio that's significant, is that reflected power lost? True or false?
True.
VDH with a comment.
VDH, go ahead with your comment.
Well, I know that the standing agreement here at this net is that the power is re-reflected from the tuner. However, total re-reflection requires looking into the tuner to be an open circuit, short circuit, or pure reactance. And that's usually not the case. Go ahead.
A well-tuned antenna tuner, a well-operating antenna tuner, takes that reflected power and re-reflects it forward. You get a chance to really radiate it. So except for the insertion loss of the transmission line, the signal flowing up and flowing back down and being absorbed twice, except for that loss of the transmission line itself, that reflected power doesn't have to be lost. High-quality antenna tuner takes care of that. Inside of your cell phone, connected to its antenna, the very first chip nearby is an antenna tuning chip. That's how that internal antenna works on so many frequencies. It forces that antenna inside to resonate at the frequency you're using right now. Resonate first and then it will radiate. So resonating antenna is very important. The exact length of the antenna is nowhere near as important. Back in the old days when we didn't have antenna tuners, we wanted the antenna to be a resonant length so that it presented a good standing wave ratio without an antenna tuner. But that Pi network in the output of your old-fashioned transmitter, that was the kind of antenna tuner. You readjust the tuning and loading coil, the tuning and loading capacitor, and maybe adjusting the coil in the inductor itself a little bit, could always force a very high efficiency of the system. Put 100 watts in that final stage, and you can be radiating 50 watts of it if that Class C stage is capable of 50% efficiency, even though the antenna is a bit of a mismatch. Anybody have any further questions or comments on the above? K2RIW listening.
VDH with a comment.
Go ahead, Mr. VDH.
Yeah, fine business. Well, quick example, I think I've done this once before. A load of 50 plus J150, go one wavelength, put a capacitor of minus J150, we now see 50 ohms, hook it up to a 50 ohm generator. On the other side, the generator sees a perfect match. However, on the antenna or the load side of that capacitor, you look in and you'll see 50 minus J150. That cannot provide total re-reflection. The only thing that will give total re-reflection is a magnitude reflection coefficient of 1, which can only be gotten by a short circuit, open circuit, or pure reactance. Go ahead.
Understand. One of the puzzles that I used to give people is that you've got a 50-ohm transmission line, a 50-ohm antenna, going into a shielded box. Inside the shielded box is an air variable capacitor, high-quality air variable capacitor. At the operating frequency, you carefully adjust the capacitor to have 50 ohms of capacitor reactance. So you've got a 50-ohm transmitter, 50-ohm coaxial transmission line, going into a shielded box. Inside the shielded box is a air variable capacitor, carefully adjusted for 50 ohms of capacitor reactance. So tell me the, when it comes back to you, Mr. VDH, tell me the prefix. What letters are in front of the VDH? So what do you believe is the standing wave ratio of that experiment that I just described? Mr. VDH, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's WA2 VDH, WA2 Victor David Henry. Okay, you said that the tuner, okay, I'm sorry, again, what was the load on that? What was the load? Go ahead.
You did say WA2, which your name is John Roosevelt, New York, okay. The load is a pure 50-ohm capacitor reactance inside the well-shielded box. So what is the standing wave ratio of that setup that I just described?
Well, if the load is a pure capacitive reactance, then the SWR would be infinity because that would be on the rim of the Smith on the rim of the Smith chart. That would be zero minus J some X sub C. Go ahead.
That's exactly right, John. So that's an infinite standing wave ratio. You put a watt going forward, but your directional watt meter, your bird watt meter, you see a watt going forward toward that box, and then you flip the slow guy. Infinite standing wave ratio at the end of a transmission line. And there's various other ways. A high quality inductor and capacitor in parallel, in series, whatever, can also give you a infinite standing wave ratio where all the power is reflected. The reason for that is that your transmitter is continuously turning out power. If what was in the box is a perfect 50 ohm dummy load, all of that power would be going into that resistor, creating heat. And the dummy load would truly be absorbing that RF energy, every cycle of it. You cannot continuously pour power into a capacitor reactant. On the positive half cycle, you're loading energy into the capacitor. On the negative half cycle, you're taking that exact amount of energy back out. The net flow into the capacitor is zero. By conservation of energy, it's all being reflected. So, and that reflected power, if it's now going back to an antenna tuner, and you carefully adjust that antenna tuner, your transmission line can now become a resonant cavity filter-like structure where the power is now bouncing back and forth between the antenna tuner, the dummy load capacitor, and the transmitter is continuously pouring power into that system. The actual voltage on that transmission line will climb to a very high number, and eventually the only thing that's got lost in that system is the non-ideal inductor and capacitor in your antenna tuner and the insertion loss of your transmission line. So those devices, the transmission line and the inductors and capacitors inside your antenna tuner, they would have to be giving off 50 watts of heat if you're running a transmitter at 50 watts. Because carefully adjusting that antenna tuner, you could make the transmitter see a pure 50 ohm load. And where's that power going? It's bouncing back and forth like crazy in that system. Any further comments on that one, John? K2LAW?
Yeah, but in the case where the generator, let's say we have a generator that has internal impedance of 50 ohms, okay, so and the load is resistive reactive, and we position the opposite type of reactants to tune out the reactants of the load somewhere on the line so that we see 50 ohms on the other side. So the generator sees a match, but on the load side of that tuner, don't we see some resistance plus some reactants? Go ahead.
Good guess, John. I think the answer is almost no. We call our transmitter a 50 ohm output. That means that if you put a 50 ohm resistive load on the output connector of that transmitter, it will give you specified performance. It'll give you 100 watts of output and side lobes 30 dB down for a single sideband transmitter. It'll give you specified performance when it's loaded with a 50 ohm resistor. You use very sophisticated equipment and you look backwards into that transmitter. You will see something very close to an open circuit. A so-called 50 ohm transmitter, in almost all cases, is very far from a 50 ohm output impedance. If it's a tube transmitter, like a 6146 or 813 or whatever, the tube type tetrode transmitters we use, that tube itself is almost an ideal constant current generator. It gives a certain amount of power output when you provide a certain load line to it. Maybe your 6146 wants to see 2,000 ohms of load on its plate circuit in order to give you specified performance. But you look back into that plate of that 6146 while it is operating. It's almost a pure open circuit because that tetro tube is almost a pure constant current generator. So it gives specified performance at 50 ohms, but it is far from 50 ohms. Therefore, the impedance you see looking into the output port of an antenna tuner properly set up is a little bit more complicated. You see what's going on there, John? W2VDH, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, Dick, I thoroughly agree that looking back into the output circuit of a transmitter there, as you say, it is most likely purely reactive and very, very complex. But if I do this experiment, say, with a 20-volt RMS generator whose internal resistance is 50 ohms, when that generator sees a 50-ohm match, it develops 10 volts across that 50-ohm resistor, 10 squared over 50, that's 2 watts. So if I use this generator on the transmission line with a tuner, I will get that entire 2 watts going to the load. And on the load side of the tuner, there will be a high SWR. But how can that power be totally re-reflected by the tuner when looking back on the load side of the tuner, looking back towards the generator, you will see some resistive component. So that's why I don't understand how you could have total re-reflection in that case. Go ahead.
Okay. Part of what's going on here is that if you had a perfect Class A amplifier made for a 50-ohm system, and if under 50-ohm load it produces 50 volts, and you remove that load and present an open circuit to it, the voltage on the output of that transmitter will go to 100 volts. When you match the impedance of an ideal resistive signal generator, you get half voltage output when it's properly loaded. Load it with a short circuit, you get 0 volts. Load it with an open circuit, you get 100 volts. Load it with 50 ohms, you get 50 volts. Now you've got, inside of that antenna tuner, a signal flowing forward from the signal generator, a signal flowing back from the mismatch of the load, and those two signals can be in phase and out of phase depending on the tuning. So there's something more complicated going on there. I know you're saying that because the real load of the transmitter is a pure 50-ohm resistor, it could be a 7 equivalent or a Norton equivalent, a signal generator. 7 equivalent is where it's a 50-ohm ideal voltage generator in series with a 50-ohm resistor inside of the black box of the transmitter. That's a 7 equivalent. A Norton equivalent would be an ideal current generator across the 50-ohm resistor. But in either case, that nearly ideal signal generator, looking back into it, always has a 50-ohm impedance. And that being on the input side of an antenna tuner, you're about to say, how can the antenna tuner take all the reflected power from the transmitter and re-reflect it forward? And that's because when you're really studying what's going on phase-wise, at that instant inside the middle of that antenna tuner, you've got a signal flowing forward from the signal generator, a signal flowing back from the antenna, and the two mix together in a funny way, giving you higher or lower voltages. Believe it or not, it is possible in that circuit to reflect. If you got that antenna tuner set up just right, it can take all that reflected power and re-reflect it forward if the transmission line is lossless. I know it's hard to believe, but I've seen it happen. Over to you, John, at K2VDH, K2RIW.
I've gone through this a couple of times, and as I say, I've tried to take the simplest case of like a load that's 50 plus J150. I go one wavelength on transmission line, that's twice around the Smith chart. I put a capacitor there of minus J150. Now I see 50 plus J0. I hook my resistive generator to it. The generator is perfectly happy. It's delivering its full power because it sees 50 plus J0. And yet on the load side, looking back to the generator, we see 50 minus J150. The resistance of the generator and that capacitive reactance that's doing the tuning. And yet, to say that the reflected power is totally re-reflected, that 50 minus J150 gives you a reflection coefficient, I think it's about 0.83 or something like that. So I don't understand how the reflected power can be totally re-reflected. I guess I'd just say that we agree to disagree, but I appreciate your time. Thank you, Dick.
If I understand you correctly, John, you're taking an antenna that's, say, inductive,